blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Everybody wants to subtract my blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Blackness, 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 blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Everybody wants to subtract my blackness. Everybody wants to attack my blackness. Blackness, blackness, blackness.
Hey everybody, welcome to the latest episode of The Other Experience. I'm very excited for tonight's guest. I think that this latest episode is going to have a lot of insight and a lot of nuance into such a complex conversation. So without any introduction, I'd like to introduce everybody to Thomas Noel Jr. Thomas, how are you, man?
Yeah, I'm doing great, JB. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate being here.
Thanks, man. Thank you. When I asked you to join and provide insight in this particular podcast project that I'm doing, I'm very just like intrigued as to your background in in education and just your navigation into some experiences that I think that you have hinted at and whatnot. And, you know, tell everybody about yourself.
Yeah, for sure. I grew up in New Jersey, northern New Jersey, a little sort of town right adjacent to Newark, New Jersey. It's a pretty urban center, I would say. The interesting thing about it is it wasn't always that way. I think the 1980s and 90s had a major transformation, as it did in many other communities around the country, with specifically regards to what we call the urbanicity or flight of people from these centers to more suburban areas. So thinking about, you know, the crack cocaine epidemic, failing schools, you know, the whole, everything that sort of goes along with that. With being from New Jersey, growing up pretty close to New York, really just having that sort of urban center understanding of, you know, what's happening in that particular geographic region of the Northeast, you know, in the 80s and 90s. Just decided to go off to college when I graduated high school. Thought I was going to be a psychiatrist, to be honest. I mean, I think that was what I thought. I wanted to study psychology. Mm-hmm. And there's something called pre-med or biology. And I didn't do very well in the science parts of undergrad. And so really had a sort of major shift in thinking about what I wanted to do. And so ended up studying psychology. Because I thought I wanted to be a child psychologist. And then some things just happened along the way. And so I ended up, I'm getting really interested in education after working at a childcare center when I was an undergraduate, and then obviously working in some schools in the Camden, New Jersey area. So yeah, now just sort of fast forwarding, at this point in my life, I had moved to the Midwest. So I'm currently living in Chicago.
Shy
City, all the way. And I'm on the faculty at DePaul University in Lincoln Park. And I'm in the College of Education, and I work with many teachers and administrators in the K-12 system, as well as administrators and faculty in higher education. So that's pretty much a little about me.
Awesome, Thomas. So, you know, you're a very educated man. You have been around various types of people, educated various types of people, all types of, you know, whether it's a man, woman, or whatever these days and whatnot. You've heard different perspectives. You've provided your perspective to youth and other people that are, you know, wanting to learn more and whatnot. So with your experience as a professor, Have you encountered any comments in regards to going into that space of being an educator? As I can hear you talk, you definitely speak well, as do I. And I'm going to say from my experience, I've had people definitely comment on things like that, whether or not being coming across or just side comments being like, oh man, you really speak well. And I'm like, yeah, thank you. Like as if it's like some like big surprise. And that's happened from Black and white people on my side. So my question to you is, being a professor and going navigating through the educational system to become a professor, and in genuine like how you carry yourself as a person, have you had any people from our own community or non-Black people comment about basically how you are, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question, and I hopefully can provide some context for you. So to directly answer your question, yes, I have had folks of varying racial and ethnic backgrounds comment on the way I speak. I've always questioned, what does it mean for one to speak well? I think that, you know, we as a society are so diverse in how we learn and how we interact and associate with others. And so, you know, I always have questioned what it means for one to really speak well. So are you saying that my grammar or technical aspect is well? Are you saying that my vocabulary, is impressive? You know, what does it mean? And the other side, I mean, what does it mean to not speak well? I think that oftentimes these things become associated with one's racial and ethnic background. Mm-hmm. So I can tell you that for me, I've had folks comment of multiple backgrounds, but also even thinking about how class plays into this. You know, I think socioeconomic status is also a really mm-hmm. huge part of thinking about how someone speaks. So I can give you a pretty specific example. So I've had colleagues, some colleagues over my time who have said that, you just articulate yourself so well, or you speak so well. And I've always thought, you know, as an early childhood, professional early in my life, I mean, that's something that you say to a toddler who's learning their language. And, that's what you say. Oh, wow, you're doing a great job. I don't know that saying that to adults. I think the interesting thing, JB, about that is people mean well when they say it. I don't think that most people who say that are coming from a place of, just sort of...
of negativity.
Ill will, right? I think that they believe that it's a compliment. And I think that's the question, is why people actually think that to be a compliment to someone else. And then who it's said to more often than not, I think is also really important for us to consider and think about. That's one example of that. And yeah, and like I said, I've heard it from folks across the sort of spectrum of race. With regards to how I speak.
Thank you for that. A great answer. And thanks for the perspective with that. Has anyone basically been negative in how they say that? Like, has anyone been like, oh, Thomas, you speak too white, or anything like that? Or has anyone been very, they think that they're talking, they think you're complimenting you, but really they're, it's like you said, it's kind of like, really? You speak well? As in that tone is saying like, they're not expecting you to speak well because you're a Black man or anything like that. Has anything like that happened to you? And if it hasn't happened to you, why do you think that happens in those cases?
Yeah. So, let me ask you, have you ever heard of code switching?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think one of the things for me very early, like probably when I was a teenager or my early 20s, because I think I did speak very differently than I did when I left high school and my environment to go to a very white, predominantly white college environment. Mm-hmm. And I think that oftentimes we are a product of our environment and where we are.
Yeah.
So I remember coming home for winter break, you know, a couple times during undergrad and talking to friends from back home or people in the neighborhood. And I remember being asked by some like, yo, why do you talk like that? And I'm like, talk like what? And they're like, you don't talk the way you used to talk. And I'm like, what do you mean? And they're like, yeah, you sound more white. Mm-hmm. And I think it was the first time in my life that I actually had ever been told something like that, you know, because I had always heard from teachers and people in those spaces that my grammar and writing was not good in that sense of like, so it's almost like you're caught in this this middle sort of middle ground of like, wait, what's going on? So these set of people say that I'm speaking differently or sounding white. These other group of people are saying you don't sound white enough in many ways when you think about how teachers are, you know, preparing students, right? But I would even go deeper and say, I find it highly problematic that how one speaks, particularly speaking well, is associated with whiteness. You know, I think that, mm-hmm. right? Because right. it would assume that because I'm not speaking what people call proper English or whatever title you want to put on it, that that is associated with race, that only white people speak in this way and whatever, you know, you can put whatever word you want there. But I find that to right. be highly problematic. And I find it to also be very sort of subconscious in the way that people think about what it means for one to be seen as intelligent or mm-hmm. smart, that it automatically has to be associated with whiteness. You know, if you let me go for a second, I want to tell you about.
Oh, go on, brother. Do your thing. That's what this is for.
Yeah, this really, really amazing scholar. You know, and professor I met when I was doing my doctoral work. And she's a cultural anthropologist and she did some work with a sociologist. And they talked to children in Washington, D.C. area. Oh, I want to say 30 or 40 years ago. Well, mm-hmm. yeah, at least 30 or 40. And her research looked at how Black students were essentially associating in being smart or intelligent or academic success, maybe is the best word, with being white. From a sociological perspective, like, why is mm-hmm. it that these children are associating, these kids in, I believe it was DC schools, were associating academic achievement with being white or acting white? And when their peers were doing it, this is what was being called out by those same Black students. And so I found that to just be really fascinating when I read it years ago. But even as I'm talking to you right now about this topic, her work sort of comes up and makes me think about this notion of acting white, right? And why
right.
those children, why those young people, right, from that community was like, man, this level of whatever these teachers or schools are saying that we need to do is more like acting white. And I think that that in and of itself is very telling with regards to how we think about intelligence, how we think about culture, how we think about identity. You know, I think about racial and ethnic identity and even varying degrees of class, of socioeconomic status around what it means for people to make those sort of comments or have those sort of belief systems around notions of speaking well, intelligence, you know, mm-hmm. achievement, success, you know, whatever sort of word you want to plop in there that folks are using. But yeah, but I've experienced it from both sides, you know, and or multiple sides, I would even say. And then also in both positive and or perceived positive.
Yeah, and negative. It's complicated.
Right. Because right. it's like, right. like you're complimenting someone, but it's really sort of a
kind of
microaggression, black, backhanded compliment, you know? And then on the negative side, it's still like, it's like, well, wow, this is how folks see me or perceive me. And what does that mean for the sort of larger context of identity?
Now, with what you just explained and how layered you explained it, did you always have that kind of perspective of looking at it and chopping it up like that? Or back when that was happening, did you get like kind of angry or question or just kind of have all these emotions of in your mind or physically like why is this a thing or anything like that? And I'm asking that because I think it's amazing how you just answered that previous question and how you broke that down. Part of the reason a big reason why I'm doing this podcast is I not only want other Black people, other brown people to explain their other experience, hence the name of the podcast. I want people to explain how they feel, how they felt, and get to the crux as to why it happens. Because it's a very complex kind of feeling and way to navigate existence, if that makes any sense. So let me know if that makes any sense in what I just said, and feel free to explain if you know, at any point got angry or sad or anything when you were experiencing such situations.
Yeah, I had a gambit of emotions, but to answer your first question directly, no, I did not have the language, I think, or really the experience to be able to deconstruct what I just explained to you in the way that I could. I would say that probably has been more recently in the last 10 years, maybe.
That's amazing. Cause it's not easy, man. I'm being honest. No. It's not easy. In fact, me being the host of this, I'm going to be very frank and honest. Like I in my head, I feel like I can talk about this all day, but when trying to deconstruct it to other audiences and trying to explain it, it's definitely been a pain point, a positive pain point, but a pain point nonetheless for me, because I want to try to, you know, dissect it and explain it. And it's such a nuanced and complex type of way of experience, if that makes any sense. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I would add that, you know, it's. So, and having experiencing those gambit of emotions throughout the course of my life, I just think I'm more aware. I've been more aware in the last 10 years or so. And I sometimes, if I'm feeling courageous, I might ask a person, oh, what do you mean? Or can you say a little bit more about that? Or that's interesting. Yeah, you know, because I think when people are forced to explain themselves, sometimes they start to recognize that either I didn't really mean what I said, or I thought I meant something else, or I never stopped to reflect and think how that might come across as offensive, or even thinking that I'm complimenting someone, but not. You know, so I think that, you know, it's also contextual, right? I think that that's the other thing that comes with things like this, is there's a lot of layered nuances and context that come along with it. And so it requires this level of what you're doing, which is conversation, dialogue. You know, dialogical practices, I think, are just so important. If we're able to do them in ways that involve safe environments where people are allowed to express themselves, I think, in a way that's safe among people, right? We just need more dialogue in society, I think, you know.
I agree 100%, man. And I think the more dialogue and you know, uncomfortable conversation. That's a shout out to Emmanuel Acho with his uncomfortable conversations with a black man years ago. I think that it's definitely true. Like the more uncomfortable, I mean, that even long time ago, I personally have always just been a fan of, let's just talk it out. Let's get to the grind it in. Let's get to the nitty gritty and talk as to why things are happening or you know, clashes between perspectives and stuff like that. Because I think that's healthier. That's healthier than other alternatives, to be honest with you. So I agree 100%. And you know, there's a lot of different perspectives and different layers to a topic such as this. What are some other comments or whatnot that you have experienced in regards to that you can think of? If you can't think of them, that's fine. That has sprung up in your daily life?
Your mom or your parents must be so proud.
Woo! Wow. I got that too before. Wow. That's, I actually, you know, to some people hearing that might be like, oh, that's amazing. And that is in many ways, but it's the tone of how it's, once again, the tone of how that can be delivered can be very interesting. Almost as if it's like this aberration or anything like that. Thomas, you're 100% right. It's an interesting window into maybe how mindsets are constructed to view black people, to view our people. It's very, very, and this is coming even with our own community at times. You know, it's just very, very, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in many regards, white supremacy is everywhere. You know, I think mm-hmm. don't be surprised everywhere. When it shows up in spaces that you don't think it would show up, even in spaces where there is no white people, it will yep. rear its head. I think this yep. is a misconception. I think that this is the sort of myth around white supremacy, is that in order for it to exist, there has to be white people around. That could not mm-hmm. be further from the truth.
Please elaborate on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's what I was saying earlier about the around, you know, notions of intelligence, notions of achievement, success are associated with whiteness. I mean, this mm-hmm. goes back, right, a lot of years ago, but right there in Philadelphia where you are, I mean, the University of Pennsylvania allowed scientists to examine brain skulls, the size yep. to equate brain size with one's intelligence, right?
Yeah.
Dr. Samuel Morton, you know, for any of you or your listeners that want to go look up old Sammy Morton, you know, Sammy Morton got paid a lot of money by the National Academy of the Sciences at the University of Pennsylvania to conduct research in craniometry, which is just the study of brains of craniums. There's a whole library there. They probably still got a basement full of those skulls, you know? Mm-hmm. Right? So, and this was used for eugenics movements, right? This was used to associate race and ethnicity with one's level of intelligence, maturation, independence, self-direction, right? So, you know, and that was only 150 years. You know, you're talking about the mid-19th century. I mean, this goes back centuries before that, if you want to go look at that sort of historical context. But yeah, so because it permeates society so much, it doesn't need people who are white for it to prosper, right? Because if you're associating right. certain things with whiteness, then subconsciously you are going to automatically, regardless of the space you're in, bring those criteria onto the situations for which you're in, or the conversations you're having, or the expectations, or, you know, really any sort of area or field of human endeavor, it's going to exist. And that's where we have to be more reflective and thoughtful, right? I think the other right. side of white supremacy is also anti-blackness. You know, I think that You know, white supremacy is not in and of itself just this thing that exists. Well, in order for people like Samuel Morton and others to be able to do this, you have to have this hate for the other, right? So this sort of hand-holding of white supremacy is actually, and not just my opinion, I would say there's many scholars out there well before me and people who have argued this, some really wonderful, some people I went to school with who do, mm-hmm. who have made some amazing, amazing work around from visual arts to literature to the social sciences and talking about anti-Blackness and white supremacy and how they hold hands. But only one of them really, you know, now, and I wouldn't even say all the time, but more recently, white, you know, I don't want to say recently, but in the last couple of decades, it's been, you know, okay to talk more about white supremacy, right. but not so much about anti-Blackness. I think anti-Blackness is still, right, because it's such a harsh sounding, you say anti-Blackness, you know, but that exists. So when you talk to me about lynchings, you talk to me about things like that, that's not just white supremacy. That's a hate for Blackness.
Yes, of course. And also, just to add to what you say, like, I'm a pop culture entertainment type guy, and there have been times where I'll look at commercials for movies or trailers for movies and stuff like that. And I'm gonna be honest, man. You know, I've seen my Rosewoods, I've seen my Glories, I've seen all types of stuff. And I think there was a relatively recent movie about slavery or something. And honestly, I even said out loud, I'm like, man. I'm not sure I can. I know it's a part of our history, but there's so much other great things that, like, way, like a plethora of great, positive, loving, amazing, inspirational examples of Blackness. And I'm freaking tired of seeing movies about slavery. How about more about love? How about more about family? How about more about rulers? Where's my Mansa Musa movie? You know, so I'm just like, so I just want to say, I completely, like, there's anti-Blackness, the parading of Black trauma is what I'm trying to say. Yes. And I completely, it's really amazing how that permeates through a lot of different avenues. It's a really, really good point that you touched on there. And it probably affects all of us in ways that we can't even perceive, sadly. So that's a great
Hollywood's obsessed with it. It's funny you point out movies, because I think Hollywood is obsessed with torturing the Black body, you know. But one of the best classes I ever took was pre-colonial Africa. Mm-hmm. There's your Mansa Musa, right? Like, so,
right.
I all the time, you know, in
the richest Cobra, man who ever lived, by the way, for people who don't, don't know that name, look him up.
We think about Black History Month, and right, and it's like, do we explore, which that's a whole nother topic, maybe you'll have another episode on that in and of itself, but
of course,
I brought it up to say that's when we, like, supposedly are supposed to, like, study Black culture and, you know, although it's been so freaking commercialized now that it's disgusting. But I was going to say pre-colonial Africa. I mean, I don't know that many people know very much about pre-colonial Africa, you know, prior to colonization. So, and what it looked like, you know, and I think a lot of what you're talking about, the celebration of culture and of excellence, you know, and of just joy and all of these things that you bring up, you know, is not discussed and put out into the pop culture, or even just generally enough. I even think about kids' curriculum, the curriculum in schools. I mean, do we do enough to celebrate Blackness?
Right. Now, with that said, do you think it's possible to, you know, Lauren, my wife, your dear friend, has introduced, didn't introduce this to me, but, like, she told me, I took the phrase, I like the phrase, two things can be true. I did it in my younger days. I maybe didn't have that mindset as much as I probably should have, but evolving as a human being and just, you know, getting older and more experienced in life, I definitely understand what that means. So with that said, do you think it's possible to hold loving blackness, but also at the same time being critical of our own community as well, into how maybe we treat each other at times? Does that make sense?
Yeah, of course. And I think one of the things I've always thought about is the Socratic notion of the only thing I know is that I do not know. And so when you think about something like that, of course, two things can be true. I don't know why things have to always be so black and white concretely, you know, when there's a lot of area for gray, there's a lot of area for intersectionality in the way that people think. So I think absolutely, I mean, I think about people, you know, so to answer your question directly, I think about this notion of intersectionality. So what it means to be, for example, a black woman.
Right.
Right. So this notion of identifying as black, but also identifying as a woman, and maybe as a black woman, right, a black woman would have a love of being black, of course, but may have criticism with the level of patriarchy and misogyny within their community. So absolutely. Yep. I mean, this is the problem. We don't allow for the intersecting of people's identity. It's either you're this or you're that. You're that or you're this.
I love that you said that, possibly, Thomas.
You know, hold differing opinions. I think that's the other problem with the racial construction and other constructions, is that it creates monoliths which don't exist. I think that the diversity of people is taken away when we look at them as all being this one thing or not being this thing.
Right.
Or as I remember, you know, the social psychologist Claude Steele wrote about in Stereotype Threat, right? You know, around how people hold these identities, and that the way society, particularly when society feels negative about some of folks' identities, it can cause some emotional and sort of psychological distress for people. And so I think what happens is oftentimes we just throw people into these boxes, like these one boxes, and say, okay, exist. And it's in this one way, right? Versus saying, well, what happens if I'm black and I'm a woman and I come from a lower socioeconomic status and I, you know, or if I'm black and I'm trans. So I think about black trans people, right? Talk about like holding these notions of identity, right? And then having a community that is extremely homophobic.
Yeah.
So, and not even just homophobic, I would say differphobic, right? In the sense that sometimes when things are different, you know, it's just like this, it's unacceptable, right? And so absolutely people have these identities that have one reflect on who they are, how they identify, and then how their community perceives them, accepts them, rejects them. You know, so yeah, absolutely two things can be true at once. You know, we just have to figure out how to navigate it, right?
And that's a great, just to bridge off that, Thomas, navigating it that's the goal. And I think in my dream of dreams, I have a vision, especially when I was younger, back when I went to Kutztown University. I actually tried to talk with people about similar topics like this, just ask questions and whatnot. And maybe the world is hopefully moving closer to this. I saw a little bit of this when the George Floyd tragedy happened, where these conversations sprung up and everything like that. And when that was happening, I was a little, I had two ranges of emotions. One, I was happy it was happening, but the other side, I was like, damn, why wasn't this happening before? Why did it take this? So it was kind of like balancing that. But in my mind, I would just love a world where I feel like the world would be such a better place for everybody, all types of people, men, women, gay, straight, trans, you know, bisexual, everybody, you know, all races, black, white, Asian, Latino, whatever, throw them all up, everybody, where we can experience being different, the differences of each other, but also being able to navigate such differences to the point where we can happily live with each other and respect each other and everything like that. So, so with that said, the other day you were mentioning, when you were over, I heard you talk about Dave Matthews Band, DMB, man.
Yeah.
So when I hear, usually I am a very eclectic type of music listener. I have been in band and performer artist. I love to do music. I've written songs. I love all types of music. I listen to movie scores. I went to see the Batman score live, played by, you know, the score is from Danny freaking Elfman, who does a bunch of Tim Burton films. I was geeking out because of the Batman score. Meanwhile, I love listening. I have in the background was a picture of me and my mother. My mom died almost 7 years ago now, and you know, rest in peace, miss her every day. But some of my greatest memories of her was playing Al Green every Sunday, Bob Marley every Sunday while chores were being done and everything like that. But I also listen to metal music. I love like screamo, emo, post-hardcore. I listen to all types of bands. I'll dabble into really anything. I've just always kind of been like that. My mom liked, you know, she introduced me to Sam Cooke, the Marvelettes, the Temptations, Bob Dylan. Like, so already just like different types of, you know, Michael Jackson, Prince. And I think that my musical journey has just always been one of just loving what I can listen to, I guess, personally. So when I heard you talk about Dave Matthews Band, I actually went to a Dave Matthews Band concert one time. it was at an event called Live 8. Do you remember that event? Does that sound familiar?
I do.
It was in 2005. When Dave Matthews came on, there was just a whiff of weed that just permeated throughout the entire millions of people. That just, where I was at, I was not far off from the steps and of the art museum. And it was just like wild. And he definitely played over his set, which I'm pretty sure, I think I've heard from other fans of Dave Matthews Band that happens. And he definitely was on something during his set. So just want to say that's awesome that you went to a Dave Matthews Band concert. How long have you been a fan? And yeah, how long have you been a fan from Dave Matthews?
Yeah. So first, shout out, rest in power to your mom and having Thank that you. Great sort of, you know, resting in power on that, just really giving you that educational musical spectrum, man. I mean, that's dope. And I have that musical spectrum too for a multitude of reasons. And I'm going to, if you allow me, I'm going to come to your Dave Matthews question in a second, because there were some things I want to say, you know, just to give some context for Dave Matthews, my interest in being a fan of DMB. So I think that I grew up in a time where there were, you know, before 106 and Park and any of that existed, mm-hmm. it was MTV in the 80s mm-hmm. on TV. And, you know, there was no,
streaming, YouTube, social media.
There you go, the media. Yeah.
Yeah.
You couldn't, like, if you wanted to hear a song, you had to listen to the radio,
right,
or you had to wait for MTV or somebody to play it, or you had mm-hmm. to go down to your record shop when it dropped and you bought it, right? Like, that was the only way you could really listen to anything that you either wanted or more than once, right?
Exactly.
And so I think with that, like, listening to a lot of MTV, like, I was hearing the other stuff, like, man, what is this? Like, I never forget the first time I heard Green Day.
Nice.
I don't forget these things, right? And then having a mom whose favorite artist is Sam Cooke and Otis Redding. Mm-hmm. So we used to drive down south to see family, and for like 8 hours in the car, I heard Otis Redding, Sam Cooke,
right,
Al Green, you know, all these Marvin artists, Gay.
Oh, everybody, King, yeah.
Right? Yep. Guess some blues and there. I mean, you know, and then I went off to college. So now I'm going to bring you to. I went off to college in the late 90s, and I roomed with a majority bunch of white guys from differing areas, and they really hit me to some music, man. I mean, because they would just be playing it in our suite. Like, mm-hmm. Who the hell? Who is that? Like, I kind of like it, but I feel like I'm not supposed to like it, but I kind of like it. Right? Like that's how I'm feeling. Like, man, that's not hip hop. That's not
right.
The one Green Day song I like. That's not the one, you know, Foo Fighters song or you know, Goo Goo Dolls, whatever that I heard that I like. And I'm like, yeah, I like that one song by those artists, but I would never buy their album or listen to it, right? Because this is, right? And you would get clowned, by the way. Like, mm-hmm. So when I went to high school, you better not show up with no Dave Matthews. They be looking at you so sideways that there was so much peer pressure, right?
Mm-hmm.
Around music that's not straight up hip hop or R&B. Mm-hmm. Like literally, right? And you're talking about a time of some of the greatest hip hop artists who ever graced the stages, from Tupac to Biggie,
yeah, to Jay-Z, era, man.
To, you know, all of Nas.
Big Dog, Nas.
Mobb Deep and Snoop Dogg and Dr. Dre, right? Like, you're talking about really, like, the epitome of hip-hop, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And to anyone who listens to this, and I didn't call out the name that I should have and I missed, I'm sorry, because I'm calling out the names of the hip-hop legends, and I know I missed a few. but I'm just speaking to that experience of what I was really centered on.
Right.
Those folks and what it was like to be in a high school where that's all that was playing, Wu-Tang, and you know, like that's all you were getting really for mm-hmm. the most part. And to even listen to anything else, unless it was in your Walkman and no one could hear it, mm-hmm. you wasn't really doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I get off to college, and the first Dave Matthews Band song I ever heard was Crash Into Me. It's probably one of his most favorite popular, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, damn, I'm really kind of feeling that song.
So, it's a great song.
Yeah, it is a great song. And so I listened to a little more, and I listened to a little more of his music. And I'm like, this is pretty cool. He also used to come to Camden a lot in the early 2000s before LaVoy Moore, rest in power, passed in that accident in 2007, I believe it was, or 6 or 7,
mm-hmm.
in the ATV accident. He was, for folks that don't know, LaVoy Moore was the woodwind expert of Dave Matthews. So from the sax to the clarinet, right, to the right flute, right, he's just the man.
All
so
of
rest
it
in power of, rest in power of more and more. So yeah,
for sure. Like,
you know, I just got into it, and then I met a buddy a few years later who was a mega Dave Matthews fan and would always be like, yo, you want to go to a concert with me? Yo, you want to go to a concert with me? And I'm like, oh, I've seen him already. And he's like, dude, it's an experience. Like, you can't go to one Dave Matthews show, right? It's just like, and that's what all his fans will tell you.
You gotta join a Dave Matthews.
You gotta join the fan club. You gotta, because and I'm gonna tell you why, you know, and I have folks in my family who are true musicians who have played and have produced music for the likes of Patti LaBelle and others.
Oh, man, what? Well, we're going to have to have a separate conversation about that.
Cousin.
What?
Yeah.
That's crazy. I
give a shout out to one of my cousins who is an amazing musician and artist. I have to tell you about him sometime. But, you know, music is, it touches souls, I think. And I think there are artists who are able to do that with their music. I think Dave Matthews Band is one of those artists, those bands who... first of all, you got it here live, right? You can listen to their studio albums, but it's a completely different experience. And, you know, I'll tell you, I've been to 24 Dave Matthews shows.
That's amazing.
yeah, 24 Ooh. Dave Matthews shows. I think I just went to my 24th in November down in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is where they started. And so, yeah, I mean, I've been to shows in Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, Virginia, Illinois, Indiana, Maryland.
All over the place, man. That's
pretty much.
That's awesome. So you've traveled, you've traveled, been to different states, been around all thousands and thousands and thousands of people. With that musical experience, did you at any point face any microaggressions? Did you get any, you know, did anyone ask you any questions like, oh, why are you here? Or like, oh, like, did anyone get, like, how can I say this? You talked about this earlier. They think they're being positive and everything, but really it's like off-putting, if that makes any sense. Like, oh my God, like, anyone act overly excited you were there because you were, you know, a Black person at a Dave Matthews Band concert? Did that not happen? I hope it didn't happen, but I'm going to assume that, you know, I'm going to make the educated guess that it's along the way, you know, you might have unfortunately heard something. I hope that's not the case, but feel free to elaborate.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you ask that. So I go to these shows with the same guy. He's about 6'3", white guy. And I have not experienced that. It's actually quite interesting.
That is awesome. I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's great.
I see more people like, hey, I'm happy you're here. And I'm going to tell you, I've been to see him in like Scranton, Pennsylvania, you know, up in Massachusetts, where I am literally, for thousands of people, I don't see one other Black or brown person. Like, there have been times where I'm there where I'm like, I know I'm not the only Black person up in here, but damn, it feels like it. Other than sometimes looking on the stage and seeing Carter back in the day when I was seeing their drummer, Carter Buford.
Right.
And, you know, you're just like, whoa, like, talk about being in a sea of whiteness. But I've actually been, I tailgated most of these shows, which is great. I mean, that's another really nice part of it, is the tailgating.
That is so fun. Yeah.
And in some ways, this is not the right word, and I'll ask for forgiveness of this word, but in some ways, it's transcended at his concert. Because I think that some of these same people, if I were to meet them in a different context, I don't know that they would be as open and loving. As you spoke to the substance use, right? I'm sure that plays into it. But I have overwhelmingly most Dave Matthews fans are really, really cool. They're nice. They're just nice, cool people. A lot of kids, like a lot of people bring their kids to his shows. And so I think it's a pretty nice environment for the most part. And so no, I haven't gotten, not that I can recall, at the 24 shows. I get more from security than I get from the people attending.
Elaborate about security. Whoa.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So one time I had some pit tickets, like the security wouldn't let me in the pit. He told me that he saw me sitting somewhere else and he let the guy I was with in, by the way.
Like
the guy I was with. Yeah, he let him in and didn't let me in. So I've had situations like that, or just sort of being watched a little more, or, you know, I actually have gotten that more from like the venue security than I have from actual concert attendees.
That's a damn shame, man.
Yeah, interesting, huh?
That's really a damn shame. Yeah. Yeah, that's a shame. Well, first off, that is, in my circles and who I've talked to, I've rarely heard that. And I'm ecstatic that you, in those experiences, did not have anything off-putting said to you, had no one say something ridiculous, or, you know, you were in the mindset, like, did you, to not even, like, care about that? Did you, now, when you were in those spaces, though, did you feel like you had to have your guard up at all or anything, or you just didn't care because you were watching, you know, one of your favorite bands?
Both. So okay. I think at the beginning of the show, whenever you're a Black body, Black brown body, and you're in that much whiteness, I think that
you have to have your guard up.
Some level of it.
True.
Listen, if you find someone else who tells you differently, I would love for you to connect me with them, because I would love to see their methods and how that works, that they're able to do that.
Fair. But I think I would too.
it becomes more, you know, I become more relaxed because to what you were asking me, the people are just really nice. Now, I will say, you know, I'm not going to sit here and paint, you know, unicorns farting rainbows and saying like it's kumbaya, because I know that, and I've experienced some levels of microaggression there, but nothing like. So usually, so you didn't know me when I had about, you know, two foot long locks,
right?
Mm-hmm. All the way down my back. And I would put it up and I would wear my, you know, tam. And I did get not harassed, but I often got asked for pot, for cannabis. Okay. Like, this guy's got, this is like the one black guy with dreads at a Dave Matthews concert. I know that dude got some pot, right? So I've gotten that, which is totally microaggressive, because it's like, yeah, you pick the one dude with locks at a DMV show and you're like, yo, man, I know you got some pot. Come on. And
right.
Like, not harassing, but like maybe starting off jokingly,
right?
But didn't get the response and then kept doing it. Like, oh,
yes.
Like, come on, man, hook me up. And it's just like, man, go ahead. I don't know you. I don't particularly want to know you. And I don't have any pot for you or cannabis for you. So
right.
I'm trying to enjoy the show with my friend. And like, you're really being a nuisance. But so that, I would say that's probably. Not probably. That is what I got more. Now that's changed in the last 5 years because I cut my hair. So I don't get it as much anymore because now I'm bald. So, but I know that a black man having locks, you know, fueled that, some of that microaggressive, like, yo, let me get some cannabis off you, man. I know you got some cannabis. I'll even buy it. Just like, let me get some. It's like, damn, man. All right. Like the black guy with locks is the drug dealer in here. Yeah. The person to your right, in front of you, behind you, and to your left has more cannabis than you know.
But right.
You feel comfortable enough to obviously come up to me and ask me. So, yeah.
And just to go further with that, I'm empathetic to what you just said, because it's like you're going to enjoy a concert. That's it. It's not that deep. You're just going to enjoy your band that you like, and you're already. I mean, not that I would expect other people to default think this. I hope that's changing, but you're already a black person with a crap load of other white people at a concert like this. I'd like to think for any black and brown person going into those spaces where they like the band and want to enjoy the experience of the band that they like listening to, with other fans of the band, that they just want to have fun and not want to have to really be in that for those 2 to 4, I guess for Dave Matthews, who knows, like 5 hours.
Yeah.
They just, you know, those individuals just want to have fun and be one with what's going on and whatnot, and not have to deal with those other unfortunate tendencies. I can sadly say that I've experienced similar things as well.
So I want to tell you a quick story. So I got to the front row of one of the whitest Dave Matthews shows I've ever been to in my 24 shows. Me and my
Where
buddy
was it?
Got Scranton, Pennsylvania.
Oh, Scranton. Okay.
And we were literally at the stage for the duration of the show. And this was one of the times I was describing, you asked me about, and I was like, man, like the sea of whiteness was actually quite uncomfortable. And this was probably earlier in my going to shows. So this is probably one of my first like five or six. This is a while ago, about 13, 14 years ago. So the show's wrapping up, and one of the things that Dave Matthews and Carter Buford does at the end of the show is Dave likes to shake the hands of the people in the front row. Carter Buford gives out his drumsticks. Okay. So I'm standing there, and I see Carter, and he comes down from behind the drum set, and he's looking, right? He's pointing at people. Cause by the way, they have people that like they know who like go to every show on the tour and like follow them, like almost Grateful Dead-ish. And so if you're ever close enough, they'll be like pointing at people like, yo, what's up, man? I just saw, yeah, you my people. So I'm watching him do that, right? I'm watching Carter do that. And I'm like waving, I'm like, yo, Carter. Carter walks over to me and he gives me his drumstick, right?
Wow.
Woo. But the story's not done. The drumstick bounces off of the palm of my hand and some jerk like grabs it and runs. Now Carter doesn't see this happen, right? Carter doesn't see this happen. So Carter walks back and he grabs the other stick and he comes and he walks and he sees me and he does like, he goes like, did I just hit you? And I'm like, we can't hear each other because it's right. But we're like kind of like,
yeah.
And he goes, I lean up like where security is. He takes the stick and he places it and closes in my hand and he goes,
man, that's what a memory. That's
one of the most awesome, you know. Yeah, and we had a bro moment. You know what I mean? We had Carter and I had a bro moment because right. I know he saw even better than me how white that show. You know what I'm saying? Like, but he picked. You know, I think I was probably the only person of even color or black like in that pit like front area, and I had these. You know, was growing out my hair, so it was just like, yeah, it was pretty cool, and yeah, I always tell that story because it was like. Being in this like sea of this all whiteness and then having your brother see you. And technically I always tell people I got sticked twice, but I lost one. But it was a pretty cool experience.
That's one of the coolest concert stories I've heard in a long time, Thomas. That's awesome. What an amazing story. I'm not gonna lie, if I went to one of my favorite bands concerts and that happened, I probably like freak out, like totally freak out like a maniac. That's really, really cool. I just had a kid. I've been out the loop with my normal music know-how these days. Are you going to be going to another Dave Matthews show anytime soon? Are they going on tour?
They're on tour right now.
Okay.
I think they're in Prague. I think they just wrapped up a show in Prague tonight. This afternoon for us. But yeah, they're doing the European tour. They've been on the European tour for a couple weeks now, and I think they're going to go until for another 2 or 3 weeks, and then the summer tour will start the end of May.
Mm-hmm.
And the summer tour usually goes from May to September. They end in the Gorge in Washington, which is pretty cool. It's actually the show that once I go there, I can retire. I want to go see them play in the Gorge in Washington. Washington State. So it's on my bucket list of where to see him, and then I could probably retire. because I'm 24 shows deep in. But yeah, to answer your question, me and my buddy are a part of the fan. He calls his fan club the Warehouse because it's named after one of his most popular songs, Warehouse, and. Mm-hmm. We got our tickets in January for when they went on sale. So I'm actually, this, you want to hear some irony? I'm going to see them for two nights in Camden in July.
Nice.
Which is right where you are, right?
Nice. Yeah. That's awesome. That's going to be great.
Yeah. So I'll be in Camden. I think it's the third weekend in July. And so I'll see him there. And then sometimes if he does extra dates and it's near me or something. And I, like, he came to Chicago last year and I was like, oh, I might as well just go. So I took some other people who had not been to Dave Matthews concerts before. And they had a blast.
That must have been a wild time.
One of my buddies I took now, like, is a pretty big Dave Matthews band fan. And he likes to go to the show. So yeah. And then every once in a while he'll do a winter tour. So that's how I saw him in Charlottesville in November, actually. Was he announced, right after the summer tour ended last year, they sometimes will do a like 10 show you know, obviously indoor venues in the winter. And so last year he did some shows from like early November to like early mid December.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, yeah. So yeah.
That's amazing, man. Not switching gears actually, but going more into music, since you just talked about Dave Matthews Band. I mentioned I'm into music. Music is my wheelhouse. So
love it.
I would love your perspective on this, because something that I've always noticed throughout my life that it just always kind of irked me. You know, you mentioned being at school and how if you weren't into, you know, hip hop and R&B and you were into this and that and the other, you would get clowned and everything like that. You know, and when I say this, I'm not putting myself on any pedestal at all when I say this. I'm saying this is my experience. So, you know, it's probably how I was raised, fortunately, for me, but I just never questioned or cared what other of our own people listened to ever. it never crossed my mind. I knew they were like, you know, when I was little, I loved Whitney Houston. I knew she wasn't a rapper. She was an amazing R&B pop star. greatest voice ever, arguably. You know, I obviously was into Michael Jackson, who did R&B, who did pop, who did rock, who did all types of music. I was big into... I was big into like hip hop. I love like, you know, I was a kid. I love like Will Smith. They got the Space Jam soundtrack and things like that. But when I particularly started to delve deep into rock music, for me, you're going to laugh at this. For me, what got me into what opened my mind, or my gateway into other really listening to other genres, was Last Resort by Papa Roach. I saw it on MTV. And I thought, I was like, oh, this is really cool. Like,
yeah,
that's what it, I'm going to be honest. I was a teenager. I was like 13 years old or something like that. And I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. This is like this dude's rapping and the ride, the guitar sounds awesome. And I just like it. And then from that moment forward, really, I just kind of started to kind of explore whatever. I remember my mom got me as I got more into more interested into guitar and everything like that, for Christmas, I got a greatest hits album from a iconic black guitarist named Wes Montgomery.
Mm.
I'm sure people really, 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 really into like classical or like old school guitar stuff really know
who he is.
But you know, he's a famous guitarist. I listened to the album and everything like that. And you know, whenever in my life I got criticized, I'm gonna be honest, it hurt for me to be I guess whenever I navigated music spaces that were not hip hop and R&B, or I said I liked this band or that artist from a genre outside of hip hop and R&B, and I heard stuff from white people, it annoyed the hell out of me. And I was like, well, black people created rock music and like all those genres, like black music, black influenced music, black music, black artists have influenced all contemporary music in America, like all around the world. Our fingerprints are all over it. So it especially hurt when black people would say or dismiss blackness, not just me, but other people I know, because of listening to rock music or listening to non hip hop and R&B music. I'm like, my first thing was like, You think that black people only did hip hop and R&B? Are you crazy? That's like what was going on in my head and everything like that, you know? And it just makes me think like, why do we do that? And I know we talked about it a little earlier, and you really broke it down very, very, very well. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, like, what, like, is it like, should everyone just Google more often, or just like learn more of our own history that we, you know, you know, Chuck Berry, like so many, you know, blues, BB King, I can go on and on. I'm going blank right now, but like, obviously if I were to think, like, I can list a plethora of artists from back in the day that are the forefathers of modern music. That's not just hip hop and R&B from black people. The queen of rock and roll. What's the nickname for the queen of rock and roll? That's Tina Turner. Like, who's associated with rock and roll in the 50s outside of Elvis Presley?
Yeah.
Chuck Berry. Yeah. Who's the greatest guitarist of all time? Arguably, Jimi Hendrix. So, it is what it is. So with everything we talked about tonight thus far, and ride with me here, with the layered conversation and nuance of navigating life with these experiences and these situations and these scenarios, what do you think are some steps you think black people, white people, everyone? It's a heavy question. What do you think are steps that people can take to be more open-minded or cognizant of the experiences and behaviors we've been discussing tonight? That's a lot. I'm not gonna lie.
It is, and I
might be another episode, y'all. Sorry.
All right. Seriously. Well, I think the first thing I would say is there's no silver bullet or panacea of, you know, to address and tackle these issues. I think that it takes a plethora of different avenues, right? I think that, for one, as you've noticed, as everyone has noticed, the last 10 years, 8 to 10 years have been extremely politically and racially polarizing.
Of course, man.
And I think it's backed people into their corners even more. And I think with one of the most dangerous things about polarization is that we stop communicating, and then we become more righteous, and then we become more indoctrinated in what we think we believe to be true. I had a elder and mentor who I really adore, who I've gotten to know over the last 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. who has been in some movements in his time. And I was visiting with him and his wife one day last year, 2 years ago. And he said to me, we were talking about some of the things that me and you were just talking about, right? Like, what right now, like about this, what can we do?
Right.
And he says to me, he said, Thomas, he said, one thing I learned in my life, and that I think is pretty true, is he said, the minute you believe that you are righteous is the minute you're wrong. And I had to sit on that when he said it. And he looked me dead in my eye and he said, the minute you're right, the minute you've decided and you believe that you are righteous, that's the day you're wrong. And I really had to wrestle with that because I found multiple meanings in it. But I think one of the things he was trying to tell me was that when we as a society, when people begin go into their corners and stay, or into their belief systems, and they disregard or even hate other belief systems or ideologies or whatever, I think we're doomed as a society. And I see us moving in that direction because I do believe that it has gotten to a point where everyone has become as righteous as they possibly could be.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, it actually demonizes the others. And the more that we do that, I think the more toxic, more harmful. I think the things that we've been talking about on this episode heighten. I think it's why you see everywhere, as the great late elder Bob Marley says, everywhere I look is war.
Right.
Right. He said that, war.
Yeah.
Everywhere is war. Or as the late great Peter Tosh said, we don't need no more nuclear war, right? It's always this level mm-hmm. of like war, right? Just all the time a conflict. And conflict that is costing. And, you know, I look at what is happening in Gaza and in Palestine and Israel.
Right.
You know, I look at Haiti. I look at the Congo. I look at Ethiopia, Sudan. I look at Syria. Right? And I could keep going like on and mm-hmm. on, right?
Yeah.
Honduras. Venezuela, right?
All around the world.
The migrant crisis that is happening. And
yeah.
Right? All of these things, right, are converging at this time. And I think that it is a bit of a warning, right, to humanity to say, hey, you all, wait a minute. You are on the path of sort of destruction, right?
Self-destruction. Yep.
Yeah.
100%.
Because eventually people stop talking. And I think that's what happens is I think people stop talking. And that's when we get war, and that's when we get such pervasive levels of violence, because the talking is done. We no longer are being dialogical with each other or practicing dialogue. And so to answer your question, I think that, you know, that's the sort of first part of how I'm answering your question. And then I think the second part is obviously the sort of other side of that is that we have to do more talking. I think that we have to. We don't have to sing Kumbaya because we don't all gotta agree.
Of course not. Yep.
And I don't need to agree with you in order for our lives to go on. Right? Like it's not about holding hands and singing Kumbaya and we all agree. But I think that democratic systems are very important. I think that being civically engaged, right, with society. I think the fact that we don't do a good job in schools of teaching children about democratic principles. And I think that we don't practice civics anymore. I don't think kids really get civics and what it means to be a citizen, a good citizen, and not a good citizen in terms of nationality, but a good citizen to humanity. I think that dignity and humanity have gone out the window. I think that people don't have dignity anymore. Or I shouldn't say that. It's not that they don't have it anymore, but I think levels of dignity have dropped. And we don't.
For sure.
Right. As a society, people aren't given grace and dignity or treated well. And I think that it has had a very prolific effect on our society. And I use that word prolifically, not in a positive way, like prolific in the sense of how just sort of enormous it is. And I just think dialogue is one of our ways back to at least having some levels of coexistence, right? I'll save my thoughts on capitalism for another for another episode of your podcast. But I think that the other problem is that the exploitation of humans, of bodies, I think has been something else for me that has created or sort of exacerbated what we're seeing is this, right? Because people have to survive, right? People have to feel
like
they can survive.
Yes.
Which means you have to, last time I checked, you have to make a living in some sort of way. And I think that many corporations and companies, including, you know, even governments have taken so large of an advantage of the exploitation of human labor and humanity in order for profits, that profits and property are more important than people's dignity, than people, than people being able to just exist.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard a saying, I don't know who said it, so I won't say, but I did hear it, and I kind of believe it. Not kind of, I believe it. I think that if your business has to exploit people to exist, then maybe you shouldn't have a business.
For sure. I totally understand that viewpoint. Definitely.
So, you know, yeah, I think we have to be more dialogical. I think we have to be more understanding. I think we have to be more gracious with each other, right? This isn't just one group doing it. I think everybody has disorders, right? But I also think that we have to address the levels of humanity and dignity that have just been stripped away from people. And a lot of it is for profits and for land theft and for ownership of natural resources, a destruction of the planet, you know. So thinking about climate justice, I think all of these things intersect and make it so it's not just racial. It's not just, there's just so many different aspects of exploitation and oppression that are happening globally, that it's creating exactly what we have been discussing, what we see, what we feel. I know that we can do better. I believe in humanity. I believe in people. I believe in goodness. Like I do, I wholeheartedly do. And I know that if we were able to listen more, judge less, come off our righteous pedestals and come out of our righteous corners. Oh joy, I couldn't imagine what the world would look like if we were able to do that. How prosperous we could be and how happy we could be. And there just wouldn't be so much suffering.
I 150%, 200%, 300%, infinity, agree with you there. And I think the way that you describe that, it's very layered. So the first part is when you were detailing that response, the foundations need to be strengthened, that you were kind of going into like the, you know, dignity, humanity, treating each other better, learning what it is to be a good citizen, the differences between right and wrong, all those things that go into that. So many different streams, and you also touched upon the other how that it's just like a, it's like those foundations aren't, at least this is what's going on in my head, those foundations aren't strengthened, aren't as strong as they should be, and therefore due to the toxicity corrodes everything else, so it streams out kind of like a virus. In a way, kind of streams out all over the place, and it affects other people in different ways, in different countries, in different societies, in different groups, in different classes, in different races, and it just kind of, you know, it's alarming, and it's crazy when you really think about it. When you were detailing your answer, I also thought of the word empathy. I think that could be thrown in there too. I think if we were all more empathetic to each other, that could go a long way as well. And you also touched on something that makes a lot of sense, in my opinion. It does. I think when people listen to things like this, or the people just assume that we want, you know, all kumbaya. No, this kumbaya does. That's not happening. That's not happening. I'll never.
I don't want a utopia.
Yeah, utopias, that's not, I agree 100%. That's unrealistic. But what can happen is empathy and being able to understand different perspectives and treat each other with respect and also have those foundations. That can realistically happen with knowing that nobody's perfect and, you know, humans are flawed, duh, you know? But I think always reaching for those goals would make life easier. For everyone, And there is nothing wrong with that, Thomas. So with that said, is there anything else that you would like to ask me or anything else on your mind? That's what this platform is for. I can talk all day, but I want my guests to share their experiences and share those thoughts. And you've certainly done that today in this episode. And I really appreciate you for it, man.
Yeah, I mean, I would thank you for getting these conversations and dialogues going and happening. I think this is one of the first steps to some of the questions that you asked about where do we go from here? Who, by the way, one of the most interesting books Dr. King ever wrote was Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos for Community.
Mm.
And I think we are at a time where that is so relevant. And so I just want to thank you for providing the space and environment for folks to be able to have this dialogue. So shout out to you and your team for doing that. And thanks for having me on. I mean, you know, hopefully I was able to provide, I don't know, some sort of context to what you're doing with your podcast and with the topic. And so, yeah, just appreciate you reaching out and let me know if there's anything else or if you're missing anything or whatever. But yeah, thank you for doing the work.
Thank you, man. No, thank you. Appreciate it. But thank you, man. I believe me, I know that this is not particularly easy to kind of decipher or talk about or explain. So, thanks to you for doing that in excellent, exquisite fashion. And I mean that with the utmost of compliments. So thank you very much. And thank you to everybody listening. Have a good one.